Well, good morning, and welcome to Green Zine here at WFVR-LP in South Royalton. Got a jam-packed show. Henry Swayze joining me from Burlington. Let's listen to Through the Pines. Maybe you're out there in the wind in the pines. Trout Steak Revival here. The vocals are going to come back. I'm going to turn it down in the mix so we can fit most of what we're going to talk about in today. We do want to thank the underwriters of this show, which has been running for 12 plus years, hosted by Henry Swayze and myself, Todd Tyson. The Yes We Can Collective, Wit and Grit restaurant up in Randolph, Vermont. Dan Lineaker's Garden Center. I Care For You, located in Bethel, right off of Route 107, the South Royalton Market, and we're just renewing their underwriting credit. They are our longest-running underwriter. And last but not least, Solar Fest. Actually, we have a few more. First Branch Coffee Company and Bale, Daniel Leibowitz. And I think that kind of wraps it up. We'll acknowledge them again at the end of the show. So let's finish up here with Trout Steak Revival. Well, good morning, Henry. You familiar with that band, Trout Steak Revival?
No, I'm not.
I didn't think so. Bluegrass fans, they're a relatively young bluegrass band out of Colorado, and I really like them. They have a song called Brighter Days, and we're looking for brighter days. We've got a kind of a windy day here, but maybe brighter days on a more national basis, and I know we're going to get into that later in the show. So tell me what's happening up your way.
Well, I've actually been in Tunbridge for multiple days and only just recently got back up here. But yesterday I went to the Renewable Energy Conference, so that was of interest and well attended. And we'll be reporting in on that. And I've been listening to an audiobook. Robin Wall McKimmer, Serviceberry, which has interesting philosophy and approach to living on Earth, and we'll be hearing a little excerpt from that. You've attended a meeting with the SolarFest people on Monday, right?
Right, over at the SolarFest Center, which is in Brandon, Vermont. And they were not only looking back at the efforts for the festival and a lot of issues to be discussed there, what the proper way forward is going to be, but some interesting proposals. I know the board is going to get together, so I'll fill in some of our listeners into what SolarFest is contemplating as they get ready for 2026. And this won't be just about planning for a festival, and that's not necessarily been locked down yet either, so I'm not going to tip my hat on that. But yeah, I want to just hit one thing in here real quick before we go to Bird Note, because I've got something that's coming up pretty soon, and that is happening at the White River Land Collaborative, which is through the Howe Bridge there. You just go north of South Royalton on 110, and the first covered bridge, you turn right. They're going to have another one of their forest walks, and it's coming up this Saturday, the 19th, at 10 a.m., and it's titled Forest Communities and Mushrooms. The walk will be led, and if you are from around here, you won't be surprised to hear it's going to be led by Emily Bowles and Dan Rudy Rudell, but they're going to have a special guest, Tad Montgomery. As Emily and Rudy navigate the group through the forest different ecosystems, Tad will share his knowledge on mushroom identification when they come across fungi growing among the trees. They're limited to 20 participants, so you should keep this in mind if you want to get signed up. Maybe if they're not to 20, you can just show up at 10 a.m. on Sunday. But the info number to make sure you're on the list is info@whiteriverlandcollaborative.com. Just wanted to get that across before we carried on.
That's excellent. So we have no guests, so this is Todd and I relating the various things we've been doing. And I've been also continually, my head is kind of wound in this because I've been focused on it, is getting myself a little bit of solar at my house to reduce my power bill, kind of in anticipation of the plug-and-play solar that will hopefully become available next year after the legislature has passed legislation for it.
Yep.
So solar is fun, and from the REV conference, there is a group, VEP, and we'll dip into them a little bit, and they're an education for understanding electricity and playing games with little models so that you can learn from them.
Yeah,
and
well,
I think they need to get into our schools and things. get into that a little bit
right
later after we.
I'm all for a sustainability curriculum. Starting maybe we'll let the kindergartners slide, but maybe starting in first grade to our future citizens who are going to be, living on their own, becoming adults, getting jobs, and how to live a lot lighter on the planet, because the folks older than them haven't done such a great job. Hey, should we go to some more migration here, Henry, on Bird Note?
Yes. I thought these guys needed a nod.
The grasshopper hawks. I'm not sure I'm familiar with the grasshopper hawk.
No, it's not an eastern bird. It's a western bird, but it's as you'll hear on Bird Note, it is akin to a red-tailed hawk, which is our most common hawk here in Vermont.
Yeah, the photo looks just like it. So let's go to Bird Note now. You're listening to Green Zine here at Royalton Community Radio.
This is Bird Note. It's late summer in Canada, and this Swayson's hawk is about to embark on an astonishing journey. Every year, they travel 12,000 miles round trip between their grassland breeding grounds in western North America and their wintering territories in the Pampas Plains of Argentina. During fall migration, Swainson's hawks form massive flocks with other migratory raptors, sometimes numbering in the tens of thousands, creating a river of raptors that flow from southern Mexico to Panama and beyond. Swainson's hawks are related to red-tailed hawks, but they are more slender, about the size of a mallard duck, and have long, pointed wings that span nearly 4 feet. Though they mostly hunt small mammals in the summer, Swainson's hawks feast almost exclusively on insects like grasshoppers and locusts while in South America. That's actually what gives them their name in Argentina, Aguilucho langostero, or grasshopper hawks. These beautiful birds have hunted bugs for millennia, but recent agricultural practices have put them both at risk. In the 1990s, pesticides in Argentina killed over 20,000 Swainson's hawks in just 2 years. The tragedy propelled scientists from the U.S. and Argentina to join forces. They banned the pesticides, preventing more deaths and gradually allowing bird populations to recover. The more than 800,000 Swainson hawks now soaring across the Americas are living proof that when we choose to act, we can make a difference. For BirdNote, I'm Shaky Espejo.
So that was for folks that couldn't quite get that. I realized in the smaller text that he was saying Swainson's hawk. So that is spelled S-W-A-I-N-S-O-N, Swainson's hawks. I wish I could pronounce the Argentinian, the Spanish name for them, the grasshopper hawks. That was a good one.
Yes. So we have to just anglicize it because that's easy for us to say. Grasshopper hawk.
Exactly.
So I was particularly drawn to this because it insurmountable problem. This hawk is dying off because of what's happening to its habitat, what's happening to its to the use of pesticides and things, and they fixed it, and that's because people paid attention and did something about it. And I think that's that's empowering. That's what we need to do, is find ways to it's going to be a theme, I think, cycling all through this program, that find a niche where you can enjoy making a difference, and things will feel better to you and will be the world will become a better place as well.
Yeah, you know, it does make me think on a wider scale. We know that I heard on the previous show, Radio EcoShock, that they're going to get together for the next COP conference in Azerbaijan, a fossil fuel driven country. So there's talk about oxymoronic, however you feel like spelling that. But do you recall, I'm pretty sure it was the Montreal Protocol many, many years ago, and I believe the goal of that was there was a large hole in the ozone layer, and chlorofluorocarbons were the primary, from aerosols, and there was a international effort to start to ban them, to limit them. I know we have HCFCs, and I believe that for the most part, the ozone hole has been closed up with international support, so a rare victory on the international scene.
You know, I was an importer from New Zealand, and that ozone hole occurred basically over the Antarctic and the Arctic. Those were the places where it opened up the widest. And New Zealand being close to the Antarctic, which is where the bigger hole was, they had severe problems. People, when they were on the beach, almost everyone had zinc oxide on their face, maximum solar block, because the cancer rates were so high from that hole in the ozone layer. And I imported electric fencing, and a lot of it had plastic in it, portable, lightweight fencing. And so that was stainless steel and plastic made into a string together, like stainless steel for conducting electric shock to the animals, and the plastic to make it light and hold it all up and give it strength. And the plastic that they routinely used down there was two, three, maybe even five times more durable than the plastics if you bought that same kind of twine made in the United States because they had so much UV degradation because of the ozone hole. So all the plastic products that we got out of New Zealand were that we resold were forced to be high quality. But the magic in it is that people got together and they did it.
Yeah,
they decided they could fix it, and the refrigeration makers, the people who were using chlorofluorocarbons for a refrigerant, said, "Oh, we can't, you know, we can't find a good substitute. This stuff really works, and we got to use it." And lo and behold, they not only found substitutes, but they found substitutes that were more efficient at making refrigerators and air conditioners work with less energy.
Right.
So it was a win-win-win all around, and it took people to realize that it was important and put their shoulder behind it and do it. And the same thing needs to be done for all CO2 emissions. We just have not. The oil industry has co-opted that and does not want to have that reduced, because there goes their bottom line profit.
And not to, you know, I'd like to stick with the positive thing, but with the COP conference coming up in Azerbaijan, I know the last one that they had a year ago, that the number of fossil fuel lobbyists vastly outnumbered the activists, the environmentalists, the scientists that were there. So that sort of tells you where we've been with these COP conferences. I don't know if it's going to change at this one or not, but as we get news from that in December, we'll certainly relay that to you. Hey, I just want to remind you, you're listening to Green Zine here at Royalton Community Radio. Yeah, go ahead, Henry.
So, and on the positive side, we've talked about Bill McKibben's book on the sun.
Here comes the sun.
Yes, and we have, and I just did the Rev Renewable Energy Conference, which is really primarily vendors of solar getting together and trying to figure out how to fix the world. And yes, they, you know, the people I know from there and the people that seem to be in those meetings are not just trying to make money putting up solar panels. They're doing that in order to try to fix climate change. The fact that they have to find a way to pay not to do that work is why they put up the solar panels. But certainly, as Bill says in our visit with him on Green Zine, and he says in extensive detail in his book, the world is making the transition off fossil fuels. And it's only the United States that is kicking and screaming and clawing its way back attempting to claw its way back to fossil fuels.
The swamp.
And a broken system because the bottom line is that we're driven by our economies. And fossil fuels, if you totally disregard the damages that they do, which one shouldn't, because there's a lot of cash on the barrelhead that comes out of the public's pocket to fix the problems that come from having burned fossil fuels. But if you disregard that, solar and wind in the right places is way cheaper, and it keeps giving. It is not just, every time you burn a barrel of oil, you've got to go and extract another barrel of oil out of the ground. You use up an acre of sunlight, and lo and behold, there's an acre of sunlight the next day. Maybe it's a little cloudy that day, so you have to wait until the day after in New England. Right. But it's a renewable resource. It keeps giving.
Yep.
All right. So you've been, let's get over into
let's head over to Brandon, and then we're going to get some more information from you, Henry, about the REV conference, and then we're going to talk a little civil liberties and stuff later in the show, which plays a role in just about every aspect of our lives. So Solarfest, which celebrated last summer its 30th anniversary, the actual festival, which is a combination of renewable energy, sustainability ideas, unique building things that are low carbon impact, often nutrition, agrivoltaics, etc., but also coupled with music and art and a little bit of performance and some kids activities. So 30th anniversary, they had to leave their sort of most popular site, which would often draw anywhere from 3,000 to 4,000 people during the course of a weekend. More than 10 or 15 years ago, they were sort of in the wilderness for a couple of years. They had a small event down in Manchester at the Southern Vermont Arts Center, which was maybe attended by 100 people, 150 people. There was a year or two, actually, a big flood came through a couple years ago. They had to cancel the festival. Another year, they had to move it to a church in Rutland, which diminished the number of workshops that they could have. Basically, it's a group that's been struggling, not just with getting enough people to be interested, but also what exactly is the mission statement? And is the mission statement that started Solarfest, I don't have that in front of me, 30 years ago, should it be the same mission statement as today? And the 30 people or so that gathered over in a very chilly barn, there was, I think, one, maybe two small electric heaters in a pretty big space with a very high ceiling. So people were bundled up all day, but they're troopers. And we had some exercises and some talks about kind of reworking the mission statement, making it seem more pertinent to today. Because, Henry, as you and I know, most people, even if they're not using solar energy or have solar panels or are part of a group net metering program, or are quite aware of what solar power is, whether they're interested in it or not, and probably aware that there's hydropower, particularly here in Vermont, a significant contributor, know about nuclear power, certainly know, in fact, most people still rely on fossil fuels to both for transportation, for heating, for manufacturing, etc. So it was a very good meeting. No final decisions were made. There were three groups in the afternoon that broke out. One group was tasked with, hey, where do we go where we just make some minor tweaks to the program here? And this included the 12 months of the Solarfest Center, because there are other educational opportunities that don't just happen during the music arts and education festival, which has been held in August the last couple of years. That group decided that, well, we still want to be mostly volunteer driven, but we probably really need to have at minimum a part-time paid executive director, possibly even somebody outside of the executive director who would report to the board of directors, a marketing public relations person who could be working on getting the word out about the Solarfest Center and its festival on a year-round basis, not just in the month or two that lead up to the festival, also someone who could reach out to other organizations who would want to rent the real estate that is there at the Solarfest Center. It's a very attractive site for other gatherings, outdoor gatherings and indoor gatherings to happen. It overlooks a very large, I think it's a 2.5 megawatt solar field just north of Brandon. So that was what group one, I was part of that group. The second group was, well, let's get more professional. Let's see if there's money there to have a full-time executive director, maybe a half-time marketing person, a volunteer coordinator. So a heftier budget item, and they were kind of stuck on where would we get the money to possibly do that. The third group was tasked with what are the possibilities of an outside larger group basically becoming the umbrella group for Solarfest. In other words, Solarfest would be underneath a larger corporation or maybe a larger nonprofit that had the funding to do some of the things that the first two groups were proposing. I couldn't help but say, well, we should ask Ben and Jerry about that and the Unilever takeover of Ben and Jerry, and that did get a couple of laughs. So it was a good exercise. A fellow named Robert Black. Henry, I don't know if you met Robert. He presented one of the workshops at Solarfest. Very good facilitator. Michael Bailey, who I think might have been up at the Rev conference with you yesterday, did a really fine job. And now we're just kind of waiting to see what the next step is. So that's a quick overview of what happened over there. Oh, and one final thing. I got there a little bit late. I didn't realize they were going to be just kind of doing an intro thing at 9:30, but there was still a charger available, so I was able to charge up my EV during the meeting. So that was a good news story for me. I was able to make it back to Tunbridge. Yep.
That, you know, and that's a kind of community sharing. I love the fact that there's it's kind of a groupy thing to say, oh, well, you know, it's a good place to charge here. And you can, I stopped by South Royalton to go to the market and go to the studio, the radio studio. And I plugged my EV in down there while I was doing those things. And I gained enough mileage to drive home without having used any electricity to go to South Royalton and back to Tunbridge.
There you go.
So it wasn't fast charging and I wasn't there long, but it paid the way.
Well, you know, the one of the key takeaways, and one of the staffers who has helped Solarfest for many, many years, I'll just say her first name, Erin, she emphasized the importance of community in the Solarfest mission. And the Solarfest Center mission, that a lot of the reason that she's involved is that she wants to be part of a growing community that really cares about issues like people that listen to this show and Henry and myself care about, and that is really uplifting to her, uplifting to other community members. And if there's a way to grow that kind of community awareness, that there is a social aspect that is very positive. I did mention towards the end that we are, you know, I'm involved with a community radio station that is, like Solarfest, all volunteers. And we have such a strong community around here on many levels, and a strong community that supports this station, that we are not having the financial challenges, at least at the moment, that a group like Solarfest is having. So that kind of community support to make things happen and keep them sustainable is all important.
So there was, at the Rev conference, there was an award to David Blittersdorf, who was one of the founders of Renewable Energy Vermont, and he got a lifetime award for supporting solar energy and all the things that he's done. And when they were first thinking about starting a Renewable Energy Vermont activity, someone stepped up, maybe him, and said, hey, we need to do this seriously, we need to have a full-time paid person. And they said, well, where's the money going to come from? And,
yeah.
You know, they went through that same problem that SolarFest is going through. And maybe Rev would be a umbrella group for SolarFest. I don't know if that was brought up, but that seems logical to me. And they had a meeting, and David said to the person who was running the meeting, well, when you call for donations to see about funding to start this, ask me first. And when it came to asking for that, David said, I'm putting in $10,000.
Mm-hmm.
So that's out of pocket. You know, I mean, he was running a serious business at that time, so he had some deep pockets from that. But and for the other people who had maybe thinking about putting $200 in, all of a sudden they had to add zeros to their.
Ooh,
to their,
he put a marker down.
They were willing to put in to make it work.
Okay,
and that was the magic glue that turned renewable energy Vermont into a serious operational organization that both lobbies and does outreach to the public and works for climate change.
Yeah, you know, and I remember, I don't know if he was the first executive director, but he was either the first or second for Renewable Energy Vermont. He is now a state senator. His name is Andy Perchlik. And the first that I heard about Rev was at a solar fest down at Middletown Springs, down at Forget Me Not Farm. And he gave a really interesting talk. I mean, I thought, well, this guy knows what's happening. This is an interesting development as far as getting an educational outlet that also is involved in developing solar power around the state. And that was back when they were basically doing a lottery for solar companies to put their hat in to see if they would get get chosen to build their solar plants in Vermont. And one of the winners of that lottery is a guy that developed a fairly large solar system just south of here, literally a mile south of where I speak to you from our studio in South Royalton. And I remember saying, wow, this sounds like such a great opportunity, Mr. Perchlik, but aren't you worried about being overwhelmed with applications? And he said, no, we're concerned we're not going to get enough. Well, I remember what happened in the next 6 months. They were oversubscribed within 6 months. Yep. Those were heady days, probably 15 years ago or so. Yep.
Yeah. Well, I think there's heady days ahead of us.
Good.
And so I guess I'll just go with the flow on this. So one of the breakout groups that I went to for the workshops at the Rev conference was on winter peaking. So summertime is now the biggest peak time in the year. That's when Vermont has to reach out beyond its Vermont production of electricity and collect power from elsewhere. And a lot of those, that peak power times, those times when it is the hottest or the coldest during the year, and we aren't meeting the demand, that peak power comes from out of state primarily, and it comes from the burning of coal and predominantly now gas. natural gas. And so those are not only adding carbon, but they're adding pollution to the atmosphere, which in terms of fatalities is probably even worse than the CO2 side of their delivery. So there are things that we need to stop that burning. We got to have a little slap on the wrist and say, hey, stop that burning.
Right.
So in that discussion, we came around to, okay, so the winter time will become our biggest peak as we move off of fossil fuel, and we have about a third of our electricity, and we'll get into this in more details when the final numbers have been published, or we'll have a discussion with Jared Duvall about it, and hopefully in the next couple of weeks. But we have about a third of our power coming from hydro, and we have that's in-state hydro. That's I'm thinking about in-state power, and about a third of it from solar panels. So those are sort of, and then maybe a smaller third from in-state wind. Now, we don't produce a lot of our power in-state. A lot of it, 40-something percent, comes from out-of-state, comes primarily from Hydro-Quebec. So that's another big water power side. But the in-state generation of hydro is much kinder to the environment than the Hydro-Quebec side of hydropower. And so so where am I going with that?
I think one thing that occurred to me when you say that the peak power load is shifting to the winter, that as we rely, which is good, more on solar power, particularly in-state generated solar power, there's a whole lot less solar power coming in the winter time. So therefore, whether it's backup batteries or other energy sources, that's going to probably drive the price up, because we're not getting as much as one of those key pillars that you mentioned, the solar part.
Yes. And especially November and December, and storage is very valuable to the grid, but at least according to people on the panels for the REV conference, the kind of storage we do that makes sense for the grid right now is really cost effective is storage for a couple of hours, shaving the peak loads off so that we aren't going to out-of-state sources and we're not paying higher prices for electricity because old clunky diesel-fired power plants had to be started up and fill in the shortfall. So as you shave that peak, you do improve the air quality of that electricity generation. But the storage for longer-term storage, something that might go for a week or a month, as you get longer and longer, get out to that month level, there isn't really cost-effective storage. I was sitting at lunch with beside a lady who is all about maintaining our in-state dams on the rivers, which have the problem that we're getting bigger rainfalls. And so those dams have to have improved spillways to take care of the bigger storms. And that takes investment and is causing trouble. And I asked her about pumped water, pumped hydro. And she said that that's a bigger project than she works on. But there is down on the Massachusetts-Vermont border, trying to say the name of it. I haven't got it quite off the tip of my tongue. But anyway, there is a mountaintop reservoir where they pump water up from the Connecticut River and let it come back down again. And when they want to store electricity, they are pumping water up. And when they want to use electricity, they're bringing it down. And it that one site actually has quite a big impact on the New England grid for having storage. But the November-December drop in sunlight, the cloudiest months of the combination of low sun angle and short days and cloudy weather, there's not much solar being produced. And the feeling was that offshore wind was going to fill that gap, that would be a way of getting that gap in. Mm-hmm. And the current administration has done a very effective job of canceling all of that. And so we're quite a number of years. That'll put us back 4+ years, even if there's a marvelous turnaround with the next administration. It won't just be a 4-year lag. A lot of things, you know, the legs were cut out from under the people who were doing all that work, and that all has to be reestablished again. I don't think it'll just be a 4-year hiccup. And so that's a way of balancing that. And that comes back to the idea of, okay, so how do we take care of this looking forward? How do we take care of this winter time peak that's going to come along? And one of the things we've already covered in a previous show is geothermal, and geothermal has the advantage. There was someone there from Lyme. Let's see if I have his. Someone there that was talking about total system integrating things together, and he was using pellet furnaces to fill in that coldest gap, not because the heat pumps couldn't do it, but because the heat pumps, air-to-air heat pumps, get less efficient as it gets cold. And the pellet furnace or wood stove, especially an efficient one, doesn't lose efficiency when the outdoor air gets cold. And he pointed out that the work that the heat pump is doing is the difference between the temperature inside that you want and the temperature outside that you are drawing warmth from. And so if it's 5 degrees below zero and you want to be 70 degrees in the house, that is a 75 degree differential that the heat pump has to make up.
Right.
But if you go to geothermal,
You're cutting that way down. Yeah.
Ground sourced heat pump, then you're looking at 50 degrees to 70. You only got a 20 degree differential. So it becomes three times as efficient in those coldest times. And Vermont Gas System was there, and they said, we're looking at going out and borrowing capital to do it, and we can borrow it at a low cost, and we can drill wells and put in a water loop that individual houses can tap into and use for their ground source heat pump. So instead of putting in air heat pump in, they can put a ground source heat pump in, and they would be paying, the homeowner would be paying for the heat pump, and probably no more money than they would for an air source heat pump. But they would get a higher efficiency deal, and then they would rent the ability to tap into the Vermont gas loop that was paying for the high cost for drilling those wells and making a 50 degree water circulation happen that they could that their heat pumps could tap into. So interesting kind of conceptual material there on how to look forward to getting rid of. And unfortunately, you know, I don't think there's a solution that we can point to that works very well for one-off houses. This
for geothermal.
For geothermal. The Vermont gas systems people are really looking at having a string of buildings that could access this loop, something where you have quite a lot of infrastructure to be heated and cooled in a relatively short distance.
Well, we should make a point of touching base with a law school graduate and then two young women that are currently going to the law school who are diving in big time into the geothermal possibilities of the town of South Royalton, and maybe check in with them after the turn of the year and once the legislature opens up and see if they've discovered if any bills are going to be presented to push this along on a wider scale, not a home-by-home basis. And I'm sure they're going to have collected a lot more data. We interviewed them, I think, about a month ago. So that's a follow-up interview that we should do, Henry. And we've got about 12 minutes left in the show.
Let me just make a loop, and then we'll do that piece from Robin.
Robin Wall Kimmer. Yep.
Yeah, Robin Wall Kimmer.
And the reason I know that name is because she is a regular contributor to Orion Magazine, the quarterly magazine that mixes fine writing, literature, nonfiction, poetry with environmental activism. Certainly couldn't recommend another magazine on that more highly than Orion. Yep.
So in the same. There was a question and answer period in this breakout group on winter, curbing winter heat. And I said, well, you know, we're hearing all about the technology. What about just making houses more efficient so we aren't having such a heat load? And is that low-hanging fruit? And some each of the board people on that group answered that in their own way, but the person who really wrapped it up and I thought was exactly right said, well, the most important, the low-hanging fruit is that we do something. And if you're not going to to do heat pumps or not going to get off your fossil fuel because you have to do, you know, a complete refit on your house to make it be the tightest possible house, that's a mistake. And that just taking action and looking at it from what makes you feel good rather than, oh, what's the cheapest or, you know, is this going to pencil out this year? Take actions that make you feel good. And so with that, let's listen to this piece from Serviceberry. And this is early in the book. And she starts off talking about Serviceberry, which is a kind of fruit that is really not super tasty fruit, but it services. It gives you food and allows you to live in harmony with nature, and it's a ready food supply for all kinds of birds and insects and butterflies and moths and so forth, as well as for people. And then she goes on to this section. I thought this is about abundance and water and embracing abundance and thinking about what stops us from embracing it.
All right, let's play this clip. Robin Wall Kimmerer here on Greenzy.
Think of a spring I know where the water is icy cold and gushes out of the ground. It almost makes you dizzy with its cold vitality. I drink from my cupped hands, splash my face, and fill my canteen for later. Isn't this how water was meant to be, free and pure? How long has it been since you drank wild water? It feels like a gift to me. The life of that water became my life and my joy in its presence. Gift thinking means that in gratitude for the drink, I'll clean the leaves from the bottom of the pool and take care not to muddy the edges. I care for the gift so it can keep on giving. But if I mistreated that spring by peeing in it or damming up water that belongs to itself and selling it off, the consequences would be an emotional breach as well as the ruination of the water quality. I'd feel as dirty as the water. It's a gut punch to even imagine someone claiming to own it. But that moral sense does not constrain an economy that views water as a commodity, property to be bought and sold. It seems absurd to me that someone could own water, a free gift that falls like the proverbial manna from heaven. Could you sell manna without spiritual jeopardy? I don't think so. How we think ripples out to how we behave. If we view these berries, or that spring, as an object, as property, it can be exploited as a commodity in a market economy. When something moves from the status of gift to the status of commodity, we can become detached from mutual responsibility. We know the consequences of that detachment. Why then have we permitted the dominance of economic systems that commoditize everything, that create scarcity instead of abundance, that promote accumulation rather than sharing? We've surrendered our values to an economic system that actively harms what we love. Our metrics of economic value, like GDP, count only monetary value in the marketplace of that which can be bought and sold. There is no room in these equations for the economic value of clean air and carbon sequestration and the ineffable riches of a forest filled with birdsong. Where is the value of a butterfly whose species has prospered for millennia and lives nowhere else on the planet? There is no formula complex enough to hold the birthplace of stories. It pains me to know that an old-growth forest is worth far more as lumber than as the lungs of the earth. And yet, I'm harnessed to this economy in ways large and small, yoked to pervasive extraction. I'm wondering how we fix that. And I'm not alone.
Yoked to pervasive extraction. Wow, that's a phrase.
Bring on renewables.
Well, one antidote, maybe.
And living in harmony with nature and with each other.
Right, right. Yeah, great philosophical comments there from Robin Wall Kimmerer. Yeah, that's an uplifting one, although a sobering one as well.
Yes, it's not all. She has more book. So that's Service Berry, and she has another book, which I also have dug into in the past, which is Braiding the Wild Sweetgrass.
Yes. Yeah, I know a number of people have read that. So, Henry, do we want to spend a couple minutes on what's coming up with No King's Day around the country?
And I think that's probably next on our agenda.
We're down.
I'm going to get covered.
Yeah, and in a couple minutes, I'm going to start an instrumental, but you go ahead and launch it. You wrote a number of quotes and things down. Why don't you get us going on that?
Yeah, so I will put this in the notes for you. So there are No Kings rally is coming up on Saturday the 18th, and there is a meeting right there on South Road in the Green from 1 to 3. But there, I've put a link in our notes, or will put a link in our notes. I haven't yet posted those. That shows them all over the state of Vermont. And there's dozens of them. It's just amazing how many options there are to do something to be counted. And I got an email from which really stirs the reason that you need to show up. So this is from back in World War II days. Most people know the version of the Reflections written by Pastor Martin Niebeler. I haven't got her name spelled right. At the end of World War II, following his release from 8 years in a Nazi concentration camp, the United States Holocaust Museum quotes the following text as one of many versions of his that he presented. First, they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me.
Powerful words, Henry. We've got a minute and a half to go. I'm just going to jump in here real quick. I remember seeing a poster with that. And you go ahead, and then I've got one more thing that's coming from the back page of the Herald. Go ahead.
I just think it's time that we do get ourselves out there and be heard rather than just shiver under the bed.
Yeah, and here are a number of people. I'm not going to read all their names because there are over 100 names of people that have affixed their names to the back page, page B10 of today's White River Valley Herald, another town that is having a No Kings rally from noon to 2 p.m. at the gazebo right in the middle of the town. And in this full-page ad that they paid probably pretty big money for, we stand in solidarity and support of democracy and the Constitution, states' rights, affordable health care, kindness, respect, and justice for all, independent branches of government, First Amendment rights, separation of church and state, and free and fair elections. Henry, I want to thank you in advance because I think you're flying solo for the next two green zines while I travel.
I am. I will see if we can have stirred up.
All right, you've been listening to Green Zine, WFVR-LP, South Royalton. Stay tuned.